Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people and stories and events of Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for this next hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Carolyn Myers and Elizabeth Baird will be joining the show a little bit later for their Ames Progressive Alliance segment, where they will be leading a conversation about Access Sexual Assault Care Center in the second half of the hour. Thank you for listening in today. It's Friday, so Dennis Hart is ready to do his roundup of last week's local news, and we'll get to that in a minute. After that, we'll get news from the natural world on the unfolding of spring, in this case, through the eyes of blackbirds. KHOI's naturalist Patch Larbaum will give a report together with Doug Haar, President and Chief Operating Officer of Iowa Audubon. Before we get started, a quick announcement. Ames Town and Gown Chamber Music Association proudly presents solo concert pianist Vadim Kolodenko at Martha Allen Ty Recital Hall on Friday, April 27th at 7:30. For this Town and Gown concert, Mr. Kolodenko offers an evening of sonatas by Mozart, Beethoven, and Prokofiev. A native of Ukraine, the pianist first toured the United States, China, and European countries at the age 13 and is heralded as gold medal winner of the 2013 Clyburn competition, and he continues to perform worldwide. Town and Gown performance, April 27th, 7:30 p.m. at Martha Allen Ty Recital Hall. Okay, take it away, Dennis.
Let's start where we usually do, with Tuesday's Ames Tribune, which reported that Boone police had given new details about the Saturday night incident in which officers shot and killed a man. Authorities said 48-year-old Timothy Wayne Anderson of Boone was fired at multiple times after he refused orders to drop a knife and charged at officers. Police had gone to 602 2nd Street in Boone after getting a call from a woman who said a man was inside a house, threatening her and another person with a knife. The woman said, in her words, "My boyfriend has gone crazy." When officers arrived on the scene, they heard yelling and screaming coming from inside. As they tried to enter, Anderson allegedly charged them while holding a knife. When he did not drop it, police opened fire, killing Anderson. Six Boone officers were placed on administrative leave, which is a common step following such incidents. Police Chief John Wiebold declined to say how many shots were fired, or if every officer involved fired their weapons. In his words, "No officer enters this career ever looking to use their firearm, but they all understand this is a portion of the career and the requirement of this job." Tuesday's Tribune also reported that Ames School Board member Rodney Briggs will resign his position effective next Wednesday. Briggs announced his decision during Monday night's board meeting. He said he and his three children are moving to the Des Moines metro area, which makes him ineligible to serve on the Ames School Board. Briggs joined the board in 2011, and he was reelected for another term in 2015. He spent more than 10 years working as a detention officer with the Story County Sheriff's Office and is now an officer with the Des Moines Police Department. Board member Monique Binken, who was elected last September, called Briggs the board member she has the closest relationship with and said he always sees the best in people through his role. Board member Gina Perez told Briggs, in her words, "You're such a great guy. I can always count on you to give me an honest answer on anything I ask. I'm really going to miss you." Also at Monday night's school board meeting, the board and district staff members met with architects to start forming a plan about what the new Ames High School will look like. Months ago, the board selected OPN Architects to design the new school. Board members have made a variety of suggestions, including such things as building a high school complete with outdoor classroom spaces, natural light, and collaboration areas for both staff and students. Other recommendations include saying goodbye to such things as traditional lockers and to classrooms that are rigid and unable to be used outside of rows of desks. Schematic design work is scheduled to run from next month until June, followed by design development from September to December. A bid for the project should go out next April, with construction going from May 2019 until early 2022. Also in Tuesday's Trib, word that about 70 people took part in a march in Ames on Monday, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act in Ames. Marchers walked from Brookside Park to City Hall. Among those who took part, Mayor John Hala, city council members and city staff, along with other area residents. More people joined the crowd when it arrived at City Hall. Mayor Hala read a proclamation declaring April Fair Housing Month and said the city council is continuing to work toward making housing accessible to people at all income levels. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that Story County conservation staff, Iowa State University students, and local Rotarians planted several trees in the Tedesco Learning Corridor on Monday night as county staff prepared to kick off the next phase in building a park. About 25 people gathered in the clearing to plant the trees from near 520th Avenue east to South Riverside Drive. They also received a visit from Ted Tedesco, the park's namesake, who served 8 years as mayor of Ames from 1998 to 2006. About 100 trees and shrubs were planted in the area just north of the Iowa State Research Park along the stream. Money for the plants came from donations from Rotary clubs and a nearly $4,000 grant. Walking and biking trails will also be installed. The park's tentative completion date is next summer. In Wednesday's Tribune, word that the Ames City Council moved forward with new proposed zoning standards for businesses along and near Lincoln Way just south of downtown during its meeting Tuesday night. Included among those standards are regulations that would make some businesses non-conforming. The council voted to prohibit warehouse and vehicle service businesses in what would become the downtown Gateway Commercial Zoning District, the land around Lincoln Way between Grand and Duff Avenues. Current non-conforming businesses like gas stations and auto service shops would be allowed to continue operations, but businesses with those uses would be prohibited from moving into the possible new district. Also during Tuesday night's meeting, the council decided that the new zoning district would not require new developments along Kellogg Avenue between Lincoln Way and the rail tracks to install parking, and that the new zoning standards would restrict parking between buildings and the street. In addition, the council approved a motion that four-bedroom apartments would be prohibited in the downtown Gateway area. All these votes gave city staff direction on how to craft an ordinance that would establish the new zoning district. The council will vote to approve it at later meetings. At Tuesday's meeting, several business owners in the area protested the possible changes, saying the current zoning is adequate or could be tweaked, and that new standards could drive out current businesses in favor of new development. While non-conforming buildings would be able to continue operation, they could not be reestablished if they stopped operation for 1 year. The downtown Gateway area is part of the city's Lincoln Way Corridor Plan, which encourages more commercial and mixed-use development along one of the city's main thoroughfares. A Chicago developer has proposed a large mixed-use project, including retail and office space and living areas, to go along Lincoln Way. Wednesday's Tribune also reported on Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting, where the supervisors took steps to limit the cost of a new transitional living center. Partnering with Mary Greeley Medical Center and the county's mental health region, the county plans to remodel its group home on Hazel Avenue in Ames and repurpose it as a crisis stabilization transitional living center. Those remodeling plans, which were estimated to cost $440,000, were up for approval before the board. The three supervisors decided to list the most expensive part of the project, the generator, estimated to cost $100,000, as an alternate during the bidding process. Taking that action allows the supervisors to see how much the county would pay a contractor to have it installed before deciding how to move forward. The supervisors also voted to set June 15th as the end date for the county providing financial relocation assistance to former Crestview Mobile Home Park residents. Last June, the board approved offering $3,000 per mobile home for the residents moving out of the park, which closed because of water quality and health hazards. For this fiscal year, the county has given about $23,000 in relocation assistance. Also in Wednesday's Tribune, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds visited Ames on Tuesday to address the Iowa FFA conference with a pitch to students to stay in Iowa once they become adults. Reynolds told the crowd of more than 6,000 high school students that their involvement with FFA sets them up to succeed in business and agriculture, and she portrayed the state as a place for young people to start their careers. Reynolds said she believes the future of the state is in small towns. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg also spoke at the conference, saying that a rural development task force is focused on building the next generation of Iowans from lightly populated areas. A U.S. News & World Report story earlier this year ranked Iowa as the best state in the nation for quality living. That same publication named Des Moines as the fourth best city to live in earlier this month. And there was more in Wednesday's Tribune, including word that Ames school principal Spence Evans was one of two finalists being considered to take over as the next superintendent of the Washington Community School District in southeast Iowa. That district covers a 208-square-mile area in the center of Washington County and a small part of Jefferson County. The district has a student enrollment of about 1,700 compared to 1,400 in Ames. If he were selected, Evans would be one of several Ames School District administrators who are leaving at the end of the school year. Superintendent Tim Taylor is retiring, and Associate Superintendent Mandy Ross is leaving to take over as the next superintendent of the Webster City Community School District. Also on the education beat, Wednesday's Tribune reported that construction plans for the Ballard Middle School have taken a big step forward. The school board indicated that a new building would cost too much money, an estimated $21 million. Renovations to the existing middle school are estimated to cost between $14 million and $16 million. The board indicated it would move forward with plans to renovate the existing structure. On the crime beat, Wednesday's Tribune had word that the trial for the third member of the group who allegedly robbed a man last summer at the Campustown Wells Fargo ATM in Ames has been set for June 5th. 18-year-old Isaiah Zion Lewis was arrested earlier this month and charged with first-degree burglary. He has pleaded not guilty. One of his alleged accomplices has a trial date set for May 22nd. The other one has a July 10th trial date. The alleged victim told police that he was withdrawing money from the ATM last July when two men approached him. One of the men pointed a gun at his head and demanded the money the victim had just withdrawn. No injuries were reported during that incident. Thursday's Tribune reported that first there were eight, then there were four, now there are six. That's the number of neighborhoods near the Iowa State University campus where the Ames City Council wants to cap rental property concentration at 25%. The council has voted to include the Old Edwards neighborhood and the Oakwood Forest neighborhood to the South Campus Area neighborhood north, the Colonial Village neighborhood, the College Creek Old Ames Middle School neighborhood, and the Oak Riverside neighborhood in the 25% overlay area. The percentage of rental homes in each of the six neighborhoods already surpasses 25%. Under the council's latest plan, no new rental registrations could be allowed in those six neighborhoods. Currently registered rental properties would be able to keep operating. Homeowners in those neighborhoods have spoken about the need for renter-homeowners balance as more renters, including Iowa State students, have entered their neighborhoods. Area real estate agents have opposed the proposed rental caps. Thursday's Trib also reported that John Deere plans to build a 33,000-square-foot facility in the Iowa State Research Park this summer. The city's Planning and Zoning Commission approved a preliminary plat for the area last week. It will need final approval from the city council. A John Deere spokesman said the company wants to build a facility to test machines that spray fertilizers. Also in Thursday's Tribune, word that organizers are asking for 1,000 volunteers to help staff the upcoming Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa Stop in Ames. The city's theme for this stop is Cycling Power, Taking the State by Storm. Its logo is a bicycle gear encompassing a cyclone. Ames will be an overnight stop for the annual ride on July 24th. As riders enter the heart of Ames by riding east on Mortensen Parkway and onto Beach Street, organizers hope to have a human wind tunnel of locals greeting them as they ride to Jack Trice Stadium for a rally. The event will then move to Brookside Park and other nearby parks to set up camp, and then to Main Street for beverages and entertainment. Organizers hope to greet riders leaving the city via South 16th Street and East Lincoln Way the next day. There was more in Thursday's Trib, including a feature story about Ames resident Greg Courtney. This month, he officially completed running a marathon in all 50 states. And if that's not enough to take your breath away, consider this. A couple of years ago, Courtney completed a long-distance bike ride in all 50 states. Courtney is an Iowa State University entomology professor. He may be the first person ever to have completed the 50-state circuit in both long bike rides and marathon running. In this week's Nevada Journal, a report on Monday's city council meeting, where the council approved a plan to digitize copies of the journal from past decades and make them available at the Nevada Public Library. The library holds copies of the journal on microfilm as far back as 1895. Patrons and staff use the microfilm machine to access historical information from the newspaper. By digitizing the collection, which will be online and available from people's homes, the newspaper will be more accessible and easier to search. Cost of digitizing the paper is about $19,000. Also at Monday's council meeting, Josie Bailey was sworn in as the newest Nevada police officer, and the council approved Northway Well and Pump Company to work on well number 5 in Nevada. Also in this week's journal, the latest class to graduate from Leadership Nevada has decided to work on a new initiative for the community. It will start with a new slogan called Nevada Nice, Be the Change. It's an effort to counteract negativity prevalent in society, and class members hope it will be the start of what they call a cultural shift for residents of Nevada. As part of this, class members created a Nevada Nice logo and would like window decals given to every Nevada homeowner through the city's water bills. A Facebook page has been started, and Nevada schools will also be encouraged to get involved. This week's journal also reported that the Nevada Public Safety Department was planning to host a distracted and impaired driving campaign event today, Friday, to help deter young people on the roads from drunk and distracted driving. The event was planned to take place one day before the Nevada prom. The Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau, the Story County Sheriff's Office, and the Iowa State Patrol were planning to assist Nevada's Public Safety Department to educate young drivers and show them the dangers of drunk or distracted driving. One more note from the journal, a feature story on a 1968 graduate of Nevada High. Mark Ritchie has had quite a career, including being elected Minnesota's Secretary of State from 2007 to 2015. Now he's president of the Minnesota World's Fair Bid Committee, and he plans to return to Nevada in June for his 50th high school class reunion. In this week's Boone News Republican, more details about the upcoming celebration of the Boone County Courthouse's 100th birthday. The big event will take place at 1 p.m. next Friday, May 4th. A rededication ceremony will take place, and courthouse tours will be offered for visitors to check out the historic building, which is on State Street in West Boone. The News Republican also reported that the Boone Area Humane Society will host its annual rummage and bake sale next Wednesday through Saturday. The event will take place at the Boone Fairgrounds. And the News Republican also reported that Freedom Flight veterans have been busy sharing their stories all around Boone County, and they recently visited Franklin Elementary School students. In this week's Story City Herald, word that communities are coming together to take care of their neighbors in emergencies by forming Rapid Action Teams for Shelters, nicknamed RATS. The idea is to have a designated shelter and RATS teams to staff those shelters. So far, RATS teams have been trained in Story City, Nevada, and Huxley. Story County Emergency Management Coordinator Keith Morgan said that while the Red Cross helps provide disaster sheltering services, it may take hours to mobilize their resources, so establishing RATS can help ensure that if a shelter is needed, it will be set up as soon as possible. Also in the Herald, a story about how numerous cities in Story County have contracted with the Sheriff's Office to provide police duties for them. Among those cities, Collins, Colo, Gilbert, Kelly, Maxwell, Roland, Slater, and Zirin. Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald said his offices charge its contract towns about half of what Ames, Nevada, Huxley, and Story City pay for their police departments. The sheriff said deputies who patrol the contract cities will appear at city council meetings to give safety updates as part of the sheriff's office community policing efforts. And one more note from the Herald. Story City Trees Forever will hold its annual tree sale tomorrow, Saturday, from 9 until noon at the former Lone Tree Nursery site. All proceeds will go to plant more trees in the Story City community. And there you have it, your weekly summary of the week's major news events through the pages of the Ames Tribune and other nearby newspapers. I'm KHOI Civic Reporter Dennis Hart, wishing you, as always, a happy, safe, and healthy weekend.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to rise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light of a dark black night. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the light of a dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
Yeah, today with Doug Haar, we're enjoying the advance of spring. And one of the things we notice are big flocks of migrating birds. Today with Doug Haar, he had a sighting that I'd like to share with our listeners. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Pat.
Yeah, could you tell us about your flock of blackbirds?
Yeah, it was about 6:40 this morning, and I'd gotten up a little bit earlier. And anyway, it was getting light out, so I pulled up the shades on our front bow window. And as I look out, I see this massive flock of blackbirds coming apparently probably from the Harrier Marsh Wildlife Area on the south side of Highway 30.
They're at Ogden.
Yes, they're at Ogden. They were flying over town and coming. It looked like it was just the start of the flock coming this way, and it was a massive, massive number of blackbirds in the front of the flock. And I really couldn't determine. You know, it was probably a mixed flock of blackbirds and grackles and cowbirds and a number of different things. But of course, the early morning light and in flight, roughly a quarter of a mile away, probably. Yeah. It was really couldn't determine what all of it was there, except it was a massive flock of blackbirds. So I started trying to do a little counting of the front of the flock, the big initial pulse, and It was very difficult to do, but I've estimated wildlife flocks or bird flocks for a long time in my career, and I'm guessing there was well over 5,000 birds in the first pulse, and then it thinned out a little bit, but then hundreds, if not thousands of more were pouring, kept pouring past. Continuous line, no stop of them, and then here comes another big pulse, and then it goes down a little bit, and then another big pulse again, and this just kept on going with the continuous flights and these big pulses of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 in a flock, and it continued for 3 minutes, roughly 3 minutes, before there was just finally a few trailing birds. And when I tried adding everything up, thinking what there might be stringing between the big flocks, I have little doubt that there was probably at least 100,000 birds that passed over Ogden in about 3 minutes this morning.
What a fantastic story to share. Tell us a little bit about the Harrier Marsh and probably where they overnighted.
Yeah, Harrier Marsh is quite well-renowned for its big roosting site for blackbirds on migration, both in the spring and fall. And I have seen flights like this in past years. It's been probably 3 or 4 years since I've seen one quite this size. But we will see massive numbers of blackbirds just before sunset and early in the morning. If you drive past Harrier Marsh, you'll see massive numbers sitting out there on the cattails and the grasses and the food crops that are left out there for wildlife and things. So it's sometimes the whole surface or the whole, if you look across the landscape, it's almost like it's a field of corn, but it's all black-topped corn because there's blackbirds sitting on absolutely every piece of vegetation at the wildlife area.
Yeah. Well, what a great public area to have in central Iowa. What a great story. Are you aware of any population declines in any of these blackbirds?
I have just read an article recently. It's a summary of a scientific article, but it states that it appears that common grackles are actually in decline across North America. Now, that may be surprising to a lot of people who have yards full of blackbirds nesting in their evergreen trees and leaving white droppings on their car in the driveway and other things.
If you could describe a grackle to our listener.
Okay. Yeah. A grackle is a little bit bigger, probably about 50% bigger, I'm going to say, than a common red-winged blackbird. It has quite a long tail, and it has a metallic glossy color, especially to the head. It can be sort of a greenish or purplish color in the light, and they have light-colored eyes. So they're quite easy to distinguish from other blackbirds. But when they're migrating or when they stop in our yard and they're under their feeders, they're all grouped together. So you'll see 3 or 4 different kinds of blackbirds in a flock like that easily.
Sure, and the eye of the grackle is kind of always jumps out at me. Could you describe their eye?
Yes. Well, it's just it almost looks like a bird is a little bit frightened.
Yeah.
I guess that would be the way to describe it. You notice the eye of a grackle much faster than you do the eye of a red-winged blackbird or a cowbird or something like that. Yeah. It's just wide-eyed and almost got kind of a frightened look to it.
Yeah.
I would say that's a decent description of it.
Yes, it is. I was kind of prying there for your description of kind of a unique look in a bird's eye.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are a couple of other blackbirds, too, that can sometimes look a little bit like grackles and will also be seen in mixed flocks, and those would be Brewer's blackbirds, which look just a little bit like smaller versions of a grackle, and then rusty blackbirds, which are getting to be quite rare. They've declined about 70% in the last 3 or 4 decades, so we don't see nearly as many rusty blackbirds as we used to.
But
the Brewer's blackbirds will sometimes be mixed in and can be mistaken for grackles, actually, too.
Yeah, and the rusty, could you give us a few field marks for those?
Yeah, they tend to be they're a blackbird, but they have a slightly rusty coloration to them, and especially the females look quite rusty.
Yeah.
But a little bit on the flanks and the upper portion of the back of the blackbirds, you'll see this slightly rusty coloration. and the eye coloration can be a little bit different too. And they've got just a slightly different chirping sound than regular blackbirds do. But you kind of have to work to pick them out of a flock when they're mixed in with other blackbirds.
Yeah, and I like to include that because there are some birders in our audience that know to look for those. I used to take all the blackbird sightings, you know, kind of take them for granted, and then sure enough, you'd start picking out the rusty ones, and it kind of gave us an incentive to look through a lot of birds. Just for to find those few rusties that might be included, knowing that their population is declining.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, we don't see so many big flocks in our backyards anymore because we have a lot of trees planted now. But when we first moved here, it was pretty well wide open in our backyard and extending into neighbors' yards, and we would see big flocks of migrating blackbirds land in the yard. And I've actually picked out all those species of blackbirds mixed in a flock right here in town in the big open area behind our house.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Thank you, Doug Haar. These are just great observations of the wilds, and you're in a special spot over there on the west bank of the Des Moines River and Harrier Marsh, and have a good day.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a fun thing to view this morning.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum and Doug Haar, for heralding in spring with the blackbirds. Doug Haar is president and chief operating officer of Iowa Audubon, and Pat Schlarbaum is a retired staff person from the Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Diversity Program, and he is KHOI's very own environmental reporter. I wanted to give a brief update the progress of the Decorah eagles. But it seems to be a little bit inconclusive right now. It does seem to have been determined that the father is permanently gone, probably deceased. The mother is with three babies, with a male admirer, but not the father of the babies. And the last news I got was that it was a little bit inconclusive as to whether the Raptor Resource Project that runs the Decorah Cam would intervene or not if the babies actually became in a life-threatening situation. They probably are deciding minute to minute themselves whether they should allow baby eagles to possibly suffer death in front of millions of school children. That's not a problem yet. The babies seem to be doing fine. And the mother eagle seems to be handling being a single mother. So that is yet to be determined what will happen there. Before we move on to speak with Carolyn Myers and Betty Baird, who are here, this is spring, and part of spring for KHOI is coming to you as the listener and asking you to help support KHOI. KHOI is in no way a given. It exists because the citizens of Central Iowa wish it to be here, and they demonstrate that by coming in and doing lots of work here and making it happen. We have a whole lot of volunteers running this place, but it also costs money. It costs about $8,000 a month to keep the lights on here and to keep the transmitter pumping sound to you. So we ask that you donate to KHOI, become a member donor for $55 or more. And the easiest way to do that is to go to KHOIFM.org, KHOIFM.org, and donate using the yellow donate button. The yellow stands for money. Give us your gold. We need it. And just a reminder that we want to, Pat Brown, is one of the folks who's made it possible for this fund drive to occur, Pat Brown, State Farm Insurance. And we thank Pat, and if you want to find out more about Pat Brown's insurance, go to patbrownagency.net. And we thank you for being with us today. Also, remember that we do, during fund drives, we have special events. And so please consider yourself invited to Radio Days if you are a member of KHOI. This is a member event. It's a celebration of the people who support KHOI. But no worries, if you aren't a member of KHOI, you can come and become a member at the event. It is on April 29th on Sunday. This is this Sunday at 4 p.m. It's going to be a radio theater performance. The Des Moines Playhouse Final Act Radio Theater Ensemble will perform Vintage Radio Show, and you will also hear reminiscences of early radio and highlights of what's happening to current radio and future radio at KHOI. And we'll also be thanking the Harry Weiss family for donating his music collection to KHOI. The celebration will occur at the Octagon Center for the Arts Community Gallery at 427 Douglas across the street from KHOI, and there'll be a reception at KHOI afterwards. So that's this coming Sunday, and Sunday afternoon at 4:30, and we look forward at 4 p.m. And we look forward to being with you if you're a member. And if you're not a member, again, never fear. We can take your donation at the event, and you will instantly be transformed into a member. You'll like it. It'll feel great. So just go online to khoifm.org if you want to be a member now, and use the donate button. This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm going to take off my host hat now and put on a guest hat during the rest of the show, and I'm going to give the host hats to Carolyn Meyer and to Elizabeth Baird, and they're going to lead a discussion about the history and future, I guess, of Access Sexual Assault Care Center. Take it away, Carolyn.
Thank you. yes, I'm Carolyn Myers, and with me today is Betty Baird, as well as Ursula Rudenberg, and Virginia, is it Griesheimer?
Griesheimer.
Okay, I was close. I appreciate you letting me know exactly how to pronounce your name. Ursula is the founding member or the founding person of Access here in Ames, and Virginia currently works in the administration side of Access, which is great as well. So we're going to be able to hear kind of both sides of how Access was started and then how it has, you know, changed over the years and turned into what it is today.
Ursula, probably 5 or 6 months ago, we were talking after a show that Ames Progressive Alliance had done, and we were out in the lobby. And we ventured on to Access, talking about Access. And in that conversation, you talked about how Access was founded. And I'm pulling out a sketchy memory that you had come back from California, perhaps, and were looking for services in Ames, and nothing existed. And could you tell us about that time and how Access came to be?
Okay. I was living in Ames at the time. I was a mural painter, and my friend, I had lived formerly in Los Angeles, and a friend of mine had a wedding in Los Angeles, and so I decided to go out to the wedding to be part of it, and I had taken a bus into Los Angeles that arrived at about midnight in Los Angeles, and this was in 1975 or six. And as soon as I got to the bus, and then I needed to go out to the suburbs, but it was right in the middle of the night. And so, as soon as I got into the bus depot, I realized that I was in a little bit over my head in terms of safety. You know, that the bus depot was clearly not a particularly safe place to be. At that time of night in Los Angeles. And so I was trying to figure out what to do because I didn't have a bus until morning to go out to the suburbs. And so I went to a police officer and asked him where he recommended that I spend the night, if there were any hotels nearby, to spend the night. I told him, I was waiting to take a bus out in the morning. And he called over an undercover policeman who was not in uniform, and said that this policeman would escort me to a hotel nearby. And then, so that policeman escorted me to a hotel which was near the bus depot. And then he left, and in retrospect, I mean, I actually went back a few years, I mean, many, many, many years later, to kind of look at the whole geography of the thing, and I saw that the police station was very close to the hotel where we were. So I think what he did is he went and he punched out, I think is what happened. And then he came back and forced his way into the hotel room and raped me, and then proceeded to basically hold me hostage for the rest of the night, deciding when he was going to kill me. He thought I was a runaway.
I looked very young at the time. I was 20, I don't know, I was in my 20s. And I tended to always look younger than I was, and so I think he thought I was a runaway. And I was fortunate. I managed to get out. I managed to get away from him. But obviously, I wasn't going to go to the police. I was in a state of terror. Actually, I was afraid that the police were going to come and find me. I went to the wedding next day, but I was in a state of terror. When I came back to Ames after this experience, I had heard that there was such a thing as a rape crisis center. It was very, very new idea at the time, but I didn't know what there really was out there for rape victims. When I got back to Ames, I looked around. I said, is there such a thing as a rape crisis center? What is that? And it turned out there was a group of people who were meeting at the YWCA at the university, led by a woman named Mary Ellen Stone. They called themselves the Mid-Iowa Rape Crisis Center, but they were essentially in the last throes of disbanding, because they had really burned themselves out trying to figure out how to do something like this. They were using a local hotline as a rape crisis line as well. It was actually a suicide line more than a rape crisis line, but they were using it that way. Well, there were about four people involved, but everybody had decided to call it quits because they just kind of couldn't figure out how to really do anything like that. And so I needed a rape crisis center to help me, and so it was clear that the only way to do that was to build what I needed. I had heard that Iowa City had a successful rape crisis center. So I went to Iowa City. I took a trip, a fact-finding trip, and I met with them at great length and basically just asked them, how do you do this? And they told me a lot of things. They had a very strong community there. They had a fully functioning rape crisis center and a lot of momentum. And the main message they said to me is that you need a paid coordinator for something like this. You can't do this on an all-volunteer basis. It's too much responsibility. And so that was kind of the takeaway that I had, is the piece of information about what needed to be the spark. And so I came back to Ames, and, you know, it's like a lot of things. When you can't figure out what to do, you just complain about it a lot, you know, the thought process. So I was kind of walking around for a few months saying, you know, this is really what we need. How are we going to do this? Blah, blah, blah. And this was the mid-70s. George Blitzos was just beginning to build up YSS, Youth and Shelter Services. At the time was called Shelter House. And so he had a lot of very bright young professionals working with him. And one of them was a good friend of mine. His name was Peter Otto. And so they were very aware of options, financial options. And there was this program that was coming through Congress through a series of congressional acts to allocate federal money to community programs. Right? Today, this is unheard of, but it was to build up community assets. You would hear regularly about these various types of funding that had become available. And Peter came to me one day and he said, Title III is happening. You should use that. I've looked it up since, and I think it was like a Vocational Education Act that Congress did. And the idea was to create funding to provide training and expansion of services for organizations that already existed. They would pay for 3 months to give a program, an organization, money to hire a new person, and then they would absorb the costs. So he said, you should just do that. So we literally, at the time there was a women's health center in town, we literally took their articles of incorporation and made a copy and put our name on it. And we went down to the courthouse in Des Moines, and we filed incorporation papers and then walked across the street to the federal funding office and submitted this grant for Title III. And I remember the guy who ran it, his name was Emmanuel Acevedo. He said, well, you know, can you absorb, you know, do you exist? And we were like, yeah, of course we do, you know, and as of, you know, half an hour. Mm-hmm. and then he said, can you absorb the money for this in 3 months? And we said, yeah, of course. And so he said, fine. And he gave us the money. At the time, the Christian Supply Store here in Ames gave us a room in their attic because we needed a business address. And so we actually put a phone in that office upstairs. It was like a little room in their attic. And my house was on 7th and Douglas, which is 3 blocks away. That was the crisis line. And so, in other words, basically I lived by the phone, you know, almost all the time. And we just set up shop. And Emmanuel Acevedo ended up being a very, very loyal supporter of this. He understood that we were lying to him. But he kept the fund. He, for at least 2 years, he just, every time this 3-month period would end, we would get bypassed. And the money just kept coming. Mm-hmm. And essentially, he committed himself to giving us this money until we figured out, he realized we were building an organization. And eventually, the turning point came when United Way gave us funding, and Iowa State, the government student body, gave us funding. And actually, I have to say, in all honesty, at the time, Iowa State was vehemently opposed to giving us funding. Mm. They did not want an independent rape crisis center in town. But it was the act of one student body president who kind of as an act of he was a senior. He knew he was leaving town anyway. He defied the university, and he gave us $10,000 from the GSB, the government student body. And that was between the United Way and the government student body. It became possible then to actually begin building an organization. And that was – so the genesis – and today Iowa State and Access, you know, have a very mm-hmm. important relationship. But that was not a given at the beginning. That act of that one student body government laid down the foundation for what today is a very, very, you know, meaningful relationship. And it was just the decision of one single person to just do this against an enormous pressure from the university and, you know, all sorts of arguments about why this didn't make any sense. So it just, you know, goes to show that, you know, a lot of personal decisions were made that, you know, set down the framework for what then became an organization.
And it also shows the importance of connections within a community and how knowing people who were able to lead you to mm-hmm. another spot, who introduced you to this person.
That's right.
That mm-hmm. it came together, which is what yeah. KHOI is about.
Yes. It is, yes. And it also has to be said that, you know, I was, I think I was 24 at the time. No, I was 26. And I had no idea how to build an organization. And so I sat down with George Blitzos at Shelter House. And he literally said to me, Ursula, this is how you build an organization, and basically gave me the blueprint that I followed. And so he really played a pivotal role, too, in making this possible.
That's wonderful. And full disclosure on my part, I owe a lot to people like Ursula for me personally, because when I was a child between the ages of 4 and 5, my mother received services through a woman's shelter in Clinton, Iowa, which is where I grew up. My father was very violent and abusive towards my mother, and she has a traumatic brain injury because of it. And so I actually got to live in a shelter for about 6 months of my life, and they really helped us a lot with getting our feet off the ground so my mother could officially leave my father and, you know, build a life as a single mom and raise me and my sister. So I really am so grateful to people like Ursula, and I really mm-hmm. am so thankful that you were able to do what you were able to do. So,
yeah, thank you. One other person has to be mentioned, too, here, which was the former Chief Seidelman in Ames. He was the police chief at mm-hmm. the time, and it was really his support that made it possible to have a rape crisis center in Ames. He took rape very, very seriously, sexual assault. And really, honestly, it was not being taken seriously mm-hmm. in Ames. People felt very strongly this was not a town where these things happened.
Sure.
And but Ray Seidelman, or Chief Seidelman, mm-hmm. he did take it seriously. And he absolutely positioned himself as a partner to me as this was being done. And so every time the police department got a suspected rape of any or sexual assault of any sort, he would immediately call me and have me partner with him. And that relationship was absolutely essential in order to be able to do this.
That's great.
The roots of an organization are so important, and I think oftentimes organizations that have been around for over 40 years don't know those early roots. And mm-hmm. you've just laid that all out, and thank you. Virginia, you are with Access, and you've been there for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw on your website, which is excellent, that you were the interim director for a period of time.
Yes, that's
correct. So tell me about what your role is now and what Access provides today. This is a little bit of a now and then.
Yeah. So currently I am helping in the administrative team. Following interim, we kind of have yet to really firm up exactly what my role is, but I'm taking all of the skills that I learned during that interim time and trying to put them to use, kind of helping our new director understand kind of our processes, a little bit of our history as well. Currently, I mean, our services have expanded significantly over the decades following the initial establishment of Access. We now serve many additional violent crime victims, including domestic abuse, stalking, harassment, and most recently, we now have a program that serves survivors of homicide and other violent felony-level crimes. So we recognized over the years that we finally had the capacity to serve a broader section of those who have been impacted by a violent crime. So we're very fortunate to have been able to absorb the responsibility of serving those folks and expand as we saw needs come up. As you said, I mean, there are still some folks, unfortunately, who believe that these issues don't touch citizens here in our community. They absolutely do. Even if sometimes those crimes are hidden, we still kind of fight that stigma and that level of kind of taboo that mm-hmm. comes with talking about these things. I think, fortunately, also our culture has grown a little bit to be more receptive when people come forward. I know that recent national movements have definitely helped move that along, and the work of activists here in the community, and that has made a tremendous impact on our ability to continue our work. We do 24-hour response, so if a survivor calls in need of immediate services, we always have three advocates at least on call, able to go and meet that person, do an assessment, figure out what they need, work with them to self-identify, you know, what's going to help you, because our role is to magnify their voice within systems that are often very difficult to navigate, and make sure that all of the care that's provided is client-centered and really focused on what they are wanting out of this. We want to be empowering. We don't want to lead the way, because the survivor really knows what they need. They're the expert in their mm-hmm. situation. So additional services that we provide, grief counseling and trauma counseling, that's a very important part of healing, and a person getting to a point where they feel like they can kind of move through their trauma and find some kind of healing as a result of that. Mm-hmm. We do provide legal advocacy, so working within civil and criminal justice systems to help a survivor understand what their options are, to have their voice heard in a system that can be very overwhelming. And we do still work very closely with law enforcement. We have close relationships that we've developed with those court professionals, because we recognize that that system's advocacy is as important a piece of what we do as the individual work.
And I learned last week from Bobby Dennis's show that this extends to other counties as well.
Absolutely.
Boone County prosecutor here, and
yeah.
he works very closely with Access as well.
Yes, yeah, that was another huge part of making all of our service expansion possible. We did start to absorb the service responsibilities in many other counties, so we currently serve.
Impressive.
Yeah, and it's mm-hmm. it's been great to partner with those local agencies and get their perspective on where those service gaps are. When folks come through their door and say, you know, I really haven't had luck accessing this resource, mm-hmm. We can work with those systems professionals to say, how can we fill in those gaps? How can we make sure that the next person that comes in has an easier time? Because ultimately, we want each time someone needs these services to be a better experience. We do support groups. We recognize that the experience of being a victim of violent crime can be very isolating. Providing them an opportunity to connect with other people who have experienced a similar victimization can also be very cathartic. We've had great success with those support groups. Over the decades, we have expanded tremendously. Kind of with each expansion comes some growing pain and that fight to maintain a level of funding that doesn't burn out staff. I mean, we always feel short-staffed. We could mm-hmm. always use additional hands, always use additional support. It is difficult work, and we, as service providers, there is always that risk of vicarious trauma. And for the most part, I think many of us come into the work with a unique kind of personal experience that shapes the way that we do work and provides us with some internal motivation to really follow through on being part of an anti-violence movement and not just doing a job. So I really appreciate the personal stories that you guys shared, because mm-hmm. I think that really speaks to mm-hmm. why we do what we do.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask, lately, in the last few years, there's been a lot more attention paid to, you know, sexual violence, sexual harassment in the media nationwide, you know, especially the current political environment that we're in. There's a lot more scrutiny about that. Now, I know that that's not always been the case. You know, a lot of times women's stories are not believed. They aren't allowed to get the help that they need. And unfortunately, some of this affects us locally. We've had several things that have happened on the state level when it comes to harassment that hadn't been handled or people feeling like they had no one to come to. How do you feel that, you know, movements like the Me Too movement and, you know, some of this more increased press about the sexual assault and the harassment, how has that changed things over the decades? So this question is kind of for both of you. You know, how do you see how that has morphed and changed with the community around women and how we interact with each other as well as how the world interacts with us?
I think from my perspective, it's really recent social media movements and national conversations have created an environment where I think it's easier to find a sense of solidarity. We're not alone in having experienced something that can feel so personal. And because of that stigma that's associated with coming forward, I think that it can be hard to find that connection. So I'm very hopeful at what these kind of movements can create as far as conversation and awareness and receptivity. When folks do come forward, I think we're moving the needle.
For me, it kind of reminds me a little bit of what happened at the onset of the rape crisis movement. Mm-hmm. For me, at least, it's helpful to think about it structurally that way. I was able to do what I did because I was aware that there was a movement afoot of in those days was called the Rape Crisis Center movement. This was a brand new concept at that time, which in many ways is similar to the Me Too movement now. And the thing that was driving that was a series of what they called speak outs that began to happen in the mid-70s. And a speak out was an evolution from what before that was called consciousness-raising groups, where women began to get together and just talk about their situation, because women didn't talk about their situations at all. Women didn't even really exist conceptually outside of, you know, the male concept of them when I was a teenager. Mm. And so it was really revolutionary to have these consciousness-raising groups where women talked about how they really felt about being a woman. And then that evolved into the speak-outs, which were public events where women publicly spoke out and said that they had been sexually attacked. And this was a very revolutionary movement at the time. And then what happens is eventually the focus changes, and then you wonder, well, did that go away or what happened? And what I see happens is when you have breakout moments like that historically, the consequences of that begin to filter down into real concrete actions on a local level everywhere. This Rape Crisis Center in Ames is a perfect example of that. I did what I did because I had heard about the speak outs. I hadn't been to one, but I had heard about them, and I knew there was such a thing as a rape crisis movement. And so then I was able to connect with people. And the reason I was able to do it is because people were organizing conferences to train each other how to counsel rape victims. And so what I'm trying to say is that it starts out as this kind of public event, and then it filters down into a lot of actual concrete legal and organizational and financial actions that are taken by individuals. And I'm very hopeful that the Me Too movement will do the same thing with sexual harassment, that, you know, it'll die down in the press, of course, because we've got lots of other things going on. But then on a local level, people will begin to use that and actually, you know, and in Iowa, we have a great example of, you know, the consequences of what Kirsten Anderson did. That will filter down all over now. She set an example in Iowa of being able to actually sue for wrongful termination. And so I think that's the hope in it. It's the spectacular public event dies away, but people begin to take local action. And that's where it filters into laws, institutions, finances, all those things that actually make real things happen.
As we are nearing the end of our time, and we're lucky to have our station manager here with us. I don't know if we'll have another minute or two. But as we're talking about connections and people are listening, how do people who want to get involved in some way, maybe by making a donation, by offering their time, by whatever, how do they do that? And if they are a person who wants to access your services, I see that there is an excellent website called assaultcarecenter.org.
But how do people reach out to you?
Absolutely, head to the website. On there, we do have an online portal where folks who would like to give financially, they can go and donate. The hotline, we have many different hotlines. The hotlines are written at the top of our website. So we have three hotlines currently, one for sexual abuse, one for domestic abuse, and then we do have also an emergency housing crisis line.
And give the website again.
www.assaultcarecenter.org, all one word.
Thank you very much, Ursula, Virginia, Carolyn. And we hope everyone has a great day. Thank you so much.